Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for the comfort of those people who have to work in the intelligence agencies, you know, constantly monitoring all the activity. We at least want to keep them entertained. Hopefully then they won't come after us, or at least they'll save us for last. Now, anyway, we are in a rushed situation here this morning, ladies and gentlemen. My guest is in his car right now, driving towards the location where he's going to be on this thing, because I didn't tell him until about maybe 15 minutes before the show that we were even doing a show. I did tell him, of course, about a month ago, but he freaking forgot. So I'm here with nothing, ladies and gentlemen, absolutely nothing, and I'm just going to try and, I don't know, pretend like I've already had a coffee. Because it's very difficult to drink on air, especially when you are the only person on air. And of course, we will be producing on air as well, so that when my guest does eventually turn up, if he eventually turns up, then we'll have to do some troubleshooting, get him on and test his microphone and test his stuff. All live for you, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be a fantastic show. I'm sure you're really, really going to love it as much as I do right at this particular moment, while I'm stuck in the mud with absolutely nothing to do and sweet nothing to talk about. So that's how you know that there's only one person doing this show. Me. I do all the producing, all the editing, all the organizing, all the everything, and that's why it's so crap. Now, I have a list of articles that is a mile long, ladies and gentlemen, a mile long, and I was thinking of like just picking them out at random and going through them until such time as the guest manages to turn up. So these are older articles, by the way, that I wanted to break down for the listening audience. Because, frankly, there's a lot of scumbaggery that goes on all the time, and often you don't know the meaning of the news until long after those news headlines are already long gone. And so this article right here from the PM Jacinda Ardern and Canada's Justin Trudeau talk women's rights in London. Now, you may not have noticed this over the recent history, ladies and gentlemen, the term feminazi or the third wave feminism or whatever it is. So essentially what's happening right now is we're experiencing a seismic shift with the view of what politics is, from about people to about men and women. All right. So basically you treat men and women as separate and completely different because they are separate and they are completely different, right? Anybody who's talked to a woman as a man will know they think a little bit differently to you. And any woman who's talked to a man, you know, they don't think that much. Anyway, did I just denigrate my entire sex doing that? Shut up, Vinny. Anyway, it is the centenary of women's suffrage in London, and Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern wasted no time in pointing out New Zealand had a 25-year head start. Yeah, we were the first to pass women's suffrage. Why? Because the British Self-Help House of Lords... Did I call them the Self-Help House of Lords? That's fantastic. I'm going to get that on a T-shirt. Decided that it would be a really good idea to test the waters, because they had all these women all over the world in their various colonies and things of that nature, going, we want to participate in the political process too. And they were like, you know what? That's really, really dangerous and uncertain. We don't know what'll happen. Why don't we just test it somewhere? Somewhere with a really small population and a whole bunch of completely isolated hicks that basically are completely ignorant of the vast majority of the world. Hey, look, there's New Zealand. Why don't we go down there and give those women the vote? We'll see what happens, mate, you know? And if something bad happens or whatever, hey, we only lost New Zealand. So they gave women the vote here after stoking it up. And I mean, like, literally stoking it up, because we're talking about, like, what was it, suffragettes and things of that nature, young debutantes being bribed in the United States around about the same time to smoke cigarettes in these big marches, and they called them torches of freedom. And these things were actually just big manipulations, these big advertising propaganda campaigns to get the image of very young and successful women smoking so that they could get other women to smoke. That's actually really the main change that came out of the women's suffrage movement, in case you haven't noticed. Because what happened is, with the experiment in New Zealand, they went, hey, look, there's a whole bunch of people now voting that hadn't been voting before, and yet they vote the same way that their husbands do. So nothing frickin' changes. Women's liberation, ladies and gentlemen, that's the pinnacle of success. I kid you not, that's basically what happened. The article goes on. Of course it does. Ardern appeared alongside Canadian PM Justin Trudeau, speaking to 80 secondary school students in City Hall in London, and had bragging rights over him because it had taken Canada until 1940 to allow all women to vote. Canada at the time, and still, a member of the British Commonwealth. Okay, i.e. a bunch of owned slaves to the evil royal family of hereditary dictators with, like... I don't need to go into it. I'm just like, oh, you guys have took a lot longer to do something that was very minorly risky, that had already been trialed elsewhere and failed anyway to get women any more rights. Oh, it's just like, oh. Now, in New Zealand, we are celebrating 125 years of women's suffrage, and in spite of being really proud of that, we have to be careful we are not complacent. Even having a female PM does not mean we have achieved equality. Now, what is equality? There's two sides of the debate. One is equality of opportunity, one is equality of outcome. So, for example, I thought about it like this. Ladies, if you want equality... you do half of the mining, okay? You do half of the oil drilling. You do half of the car manufacturing. You do half of everything, okay? You do these things like, what was it, Steve Hughes was talking about, this woman saying that men have never done anything for us. Yeah, except build the world, all right? You know why there aren't any women on those oil derricks in the North Sea at 40 below? Afraid that you're going to get your skull smacked in or be paralyzed for the rest of your life through some heavy drilling equipment smacking you on the back of the head? You know? Women don't do these jobs. Men do. But the women drive around in the cars that are fueled by the petrol that the men put their lives quite literally at risk in order to obtain for you so that you can get your kids to school and soccer and what have you. All right, that's basically how unequal society is. The women get to drive to work with the petrol that the guy suffered and died for 300 days out of the year. On okay, and we haven't got equality yet. By the way, we don't have equality. We need to increase that equality. We want 50% of those oil rigs to be manned by women now. All right, we want them to be covered in shit and slime and oil and crap. 300 days out of the year, freezing their very pretty asses off, and then getting a whole bunch of those guys on those oil rigs to accept them as women. It's like, we'll accept you as women as soon as you do the same amount of work. All right? Okay, so that's the difference between equality of opportunity and equality of outcome. Women already have the opportunity to commit 87% of the suicides like men do, but they don't for some reason. We need to get more women committing suicide, okay? It's just not fair. All right, and you go, all right, well, what else is the other thing on this? Getting paid. All right, so, men get paid on average more than women. Really? Who are the majority of entrepreneurs? Who are the majority of people who invent stuff? Who are the majority of X, Y, and Z people who, like, bust their ass and put themselves in really dangerous positions for real high pay? It's men who do a lot of that. And that's why there's some statistic that represents us having a slightly higher pay grade. And that ain't because we get paid more to do the same job. It's because we get paid more on average because we've got a testosterone drive that women generally don't have. Unless they're a feminist, of course, in which case their testosterone is just off the charts. Now, my very special guest, Lauren Lockwood, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. How are you?
Yeah, somewhat fabulous is my standard response. But now that you're here, it's frickin' awesome.
Yeah. I'm sorry I'm late.
Don't worry. I'm sorry I only gave you 15 minutes. All right. So, just for those who don't know, Lauren, would you please give us a little bit of background about who you are and what it is you do? Because you haven't been on the show for like nearly half a decade.
It's been a while. Yeah. We did a couple shows together, but it's been a while. Yeah, I run the largest water-only fasting center in the world, the Tanglewood Wellness Center. We're located in Costa Rica. We turned 21 in March. We have taken thousands of people through fast, averaging 26 days. And, you know, I know that probably blows a lot of people's minds because a lot of people think if they miss lunch, they'll probably die. But, you know, in fact, the average person can go 6 to 8 weeks without eating if they do it properly, and amazing things happen. So we can get into that however you want to. I'll leave that up to you. But what I've been doing for the last 27 years is helping people maximize their health. And for the last 21 years, through this particular vehicle, the Tanglewood Wellness Center.
So what actually got you interested in fasting and that kind of thing? Because you haven't been doing this all your life. You had good decades and decades before you actually really started this up and started going for it. What tipped you over the scale?
Yeah, well, what happened, you know, I think my story is probably not so unusual, Vinny, in that I got very sick and medicine failed me. I was 23 years old. I was just out of school. Within about 6 months, I was sicker than anyone I knew. And I spent 3 years going to doctors and I got worse all the time. And in fact, most of what I was dealing with, they told me didn't exist. They told me it wasn't real. And so I finally realized that they weren't helping me. And if I wanted my health back, I was going to have to figure it out myself. And that's what I did.
Just through water.
Well, not exactly. I mean, you know, what happened is, I mean, first of all, look, I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. It's a pretty conservative town in some ways. And medically, you know, all we had, I mean, you know, Southern California, they were probably for decades, there have been dozens of alternatives. But Washington, D.C., we had allopathic medicine. That was it. And so when medicine failed me, I wasn't really sure where to turn. I had started studying nutrition 10 years or so before. And so I went back to nutrition, realized I was already doing everything nutrition said I should be doing. And I was still sicker than anyone I knew. So I thought, okay, well, this doesn't work. And started thinking about why that was. Wound up making, the realization I came to is that every species on the planet has a natural diet. And yet the diet I'd grown up with was far from natural for me or anyone else. It was, you know, processed foods and all kinds of stuff that never belonged in the human body. And so I changed my diet. And around the same time, I came across a book called Rational Fasting. You may be familiar with it, written by Arnold Arendt back in the 20s. And Arendt was long dead. He died actually, I think, a year or so after the book was published. This was all pre-internet. So I had, you know, I couldn't Google it. I couldn't go on YouTube and find videos on it. I was on my own. Back then we had a search engine. It was called a phone book. And if you went to the yellow pages in the phone book where the businesses were listed and you looked under fasting, you know what it said?
Nothing.
Exactly. Nothing. So it never even occurred to me to go to the library. I probably could have done research. There were actually places you could go. There were more places then than there are now. And because many people have been driven out of business by the medical associations and, they play hard. And so I was on my own. I had grown up with fasting as part of my life. I like to say I'm Jewish, but only on my parents' side, both parents. Not religious, but, you know, I grew up fasting one day a year. I knew I could survive 24 hours, which I truly believe is much longer than most people think they could survive without food. I knew I could do that. So I parked myself close to the refrigerator and I tried 2 days. And when I succeeded with that, I went 4 days. And I worked my way up until I was fasting for weeks at a time. And amazing things happened for me. Everything shifted. Over in 6 months' time, I went from being sicker than anyone I knew to being weller than anyone I knew.
How did you think did that affect your relationships with all your friends and things like that? Because when people tend to do something different to what everybody else is doing, they don't like it for some reason.
Yeah, well, you know, fortunately, it did have some impact, but it wasn't as dramatic as it may be for many people. I grew up in an area where people were well-educated and relatively open-minded. And so, you know, none of my friends dropped me because of it. None of them felt threatened in any significant way, as far as I could tell. I have to admit, there were fewer and fewer dinner invitations. But
this guy doesn't eat. You know, why are we going to invite him to dinner?
Exactly. But, you know, but the bottom line is that ultimately it does indeed shift things. And it shifts things not so much because people rejected me or my ideas. There probably was some of that happening. But really what happened is that as I shifted, what I was interested in shifted. You know, I'd grown up partying pretty hard through high school and college. And my old friends and I had less in common, right? You know, the people that were still, they were thinking, we've got free time, you know, we're going to use it smoking or drinking something. And I just wasn't interested in that anymore. And so, and of course, over time, many of my old friends have also taken their own diversions from the path we were on together. And we now have perhaps more in common than we would have 27 years ago when I first started my it's been 32 years when I really started to diverge from the common path. You know, back then, yeah, at one point it seemed like I had very little in common except for the shared history. And today it's really more than it was. But that's how I got into it. And, you know, I had no intention. I mean, I thought I would take care of my own health. That would be that. As you said, I had decades doing other things. I was actually running a commercial real estate company in Washington, D.C., and the change in me was so dramatic from being so sick to being so well that people who knew me would come up to me and say, oh my God, you look amazing. What did you do? You know, could you help my sister? Could you help my son or my father, my grandmother? And before I knew it, I was spending more time helping people make better choices than I spent running my real estate business. And I realized after a few years, it wasn't a very good way to pay the bill, spending my time doing something I wasn't getting paid at all. I wasn't charging anyone for my help. But, you know, I wanted to help people. I wanted to see people get well. And I truly believe in it. I mean, I think you're doing something here that's benefiting a lot of people. And, I don't unfortunately get a chance to watch many videos or listen to many programs. So I haven't been able to follow all your shows since you and I last spoke together.
Thank you, by the way, because that's actually the point of the show, is to make people live their own life and get stuff done helping other people rather than listening to a show that gives them the inspiration to do such a thing.
Right. Well, I appreciate that, too. But, you know, I think the point is you're sharing information which is, in many cases, alternative information. Maybe every case it's alternative information. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything you're sharing is true or right, or that I agree with it, or that anyone else should agree with it.
If people come on the show, it doesn't even mean that I agree with them. It's more of the
exactly
fact that either I haven't talked to them before, or I don't know exactly what they're saying, and I want to freaking know. And I think that curiosity within me has been killed in the general population. Like, seriously, an intellectual gun to the head. Stop being curious about stuff. Don't talk to that person. He's talking about stuff that's not true and everything like that. But I haven't investigated it yet. How do I know if it's not true enough? Just don't talk to it. You know,
I think the ability to be curious about something requires the ability to think about something, actually to consider things. And most people aren't doing a whole lot of thinking anymore. You know, people sedate themselves with food, alcohol, drugs, television, pornography, Facebook, and really aren't living much of a life. And so what you're offering is a tremendous service, because you're offering people a chance to look at alternatives that they may not have considered. They can make their own decisions. I hear you completely. I respect the fact that you're not just representing the things that you necessarily agree with, but you're willing to put various different viewpoints across.
But occasionally that means I'll get a guest that is, in my opinion, just a complete scam artist and crazy, and I had to sit there for 2 hours continuing to riff and pretend like I'm interested.
Well, I hope with all due respect, I hope it's okay to disagree with you here, but I don't think so. I think what you could do is you could simply be honest. You could call them out where you think they should be called out. I would encourage you to do exactly the same with me. I've done lots of radio and TV shows over the years, normal radio, internet radio, whatever, all kinds of things. Not every case has the host been friendly. In some cases, you know, they're looking at me going, this sounds like a scam. This is crazy. Let's get this guy on here and tear him apart. And, you know, and sometimes they succeed to a greater extent than others, and sometimes they don't. It just depends. But, you know, if people give me a chance to express myself and explain myself, I'm completely okay with whatever their viewpoint is. Yeah. I believe, as I think you do, that the point here is to simply share something and let the intelligent listeners come to their own conclusions. I guarantee there's people right now listening to this going, wait a second, did that guy say people go weeks without eating anything? And supposedly in the name of health, how could that possibly be a good thing?
Yeah. And then what you do in those situations is you ask very simple, basic questions that actually get to the truth of stuff, but aren't oppositional in nature and aren't aggressive in nature. So that way, you're giving somebody enough rope to hang themselves with if they're lying, and you're right. Giving them enough time to express the truth if they're telling it.
Right, right. Well, obviously, now we're talking about your area of expertise. You're the talk show host. You're the guy that knows how to do that. That's what you just said is brilliant and makes perfect sense and probably comes across a lot better than attacking somebody on the air.
Which means it will get less hits because people want aggression, opposition, anger,
well, that's
and
true.
That kind of thing. Now, if you
call each other names if you like.
Oh, we love doing that. Now, the thing is though, if you look at any conversation that we've ever had in our entire lives, ladies and gentlemen, where you and the other person are yelling at each other with two diametrically opposed viewpoints, two questions. One, is either of you listening to the other? Two, right. Was your mind changed by the end of that interaction? The answer is
right.
No on both counts.
Usually not. Right, exactly.
So, calm. Right. Listen, investigation, openness. This is the way that human beings have actually evolved from being clubbing each other and dragging women into the cave to now we pay by credit card. Okay, like this is how evolution works, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, you know, I can't remember who said it, but someone once said one of the most difficult things to do is to hold two opposing ideas in your mind at the same time. You know, to not reject everything you hear that doesn't agree with your own pre-existing ideas, but to be willing to consider it. I've got this belief, and now I'm hearing this idea. How do those two things jibe? How do they balance? How do they, you know? And then again, let people come to their own conclusions.
Who, what, when, where, why, and how? What's the history behind fasting? I mean, historically, going back through time, this is a practice that's been around for quite some time, hasn't it, Lauren?
Well, yes, it's been around actually forever because, in fact, you know, it's estimated today, no one's actually counted them all, but that there are approximately 25.5 million animal species on the planet. And as far as science knows, virtually every single one of them, when sick enough or badly enough injured, will lie down and stop eating. So this is nature's way of allowing the organism to heal itself. And I just said something that is probably not necessarily obvious to everyone. You know, we've all grown up. We've grown up on opposite sides of the Atlantic, but we've both grown up with the idea that we take things to heal the body, or that we have something done to us to make us heal. And first of all, as a starting point, I'm coming from a different paradigm completely. That paradigm says every species on the planet, including our amazing bodies, are completely self-healing and self-cleansing. So nothing we can take, no medication, no herb, no superfood, no smoothie, no anything can make the body heal. The body heals itself. The very best we can do, in my opinion, is to get out of the body's way, providing it the optimal conditions and opportunity to heal. So that's all that fasting does. It's not that fasting has some magical power, although there are amazing physiological changes that occur only in the absence of calories and nutrients. So again, this is probably counterintuitive to many people. Many people think, yeah, but don't you need nutrients from food in order to heal? Well, generally speaking, the answer is no. Obviously,
If I may,
please.
The other week, we had a really filthy washing machine, and we ran it through with an empty cycle with some lemon and some baking soda, and now we've got a clean washing machine. That's not entirely dissimilar a process from what's happening when you're fasting the body. You know, it's not full of crap anymore that it's trying to process, and it's just running
That's
a
right.
clean cycle. Huh?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The only difference, and you know, this is the challenge of these kinds of analogies. For 27 years now that I've been speaking about these things and sharing this information with my clients, I use analogy of a car in many times. But you know what? We're not machines. The difference is that the washing machine cannot clean itself. It can't do anything until you actually plug it in and turn it on. You have to be in control of that thing. But every living organism, even if it doesn't know anything about cleansing, even if it doesn't know whatever it needs, you know, needs to happen, if we get out of its way, it is going to do everything it possibly can to cleanse and heal itself. It may or may not succeed, depending on the nature of the problem, but it's going to do everything it's possible, you know, it's capable of doing, and it's completely designed to be able to eliminate anything that doesn't belong, where the washing machine can only do that if you assist it.
That's about right, isn't it? A self-cleaning washing machine. Actually, there was this one time when we expressed an analogy, I think, to Cliff High about the human race being kind of like a mechanical spring being held down by tyranny and ignorance and that kind of thing. But the longer you hold it down, the more it tries to push back up, right? And he says, no. Let's use an organic analogy. It's a water spring. What happens when you try to hold down a water spring? It starts spewing forth in all kinds of different directions and burrowing through rock, and then starts coming up. You can't stop it. Much better.
Exactly.
So that's the problem as well, is when you're making an analogy of the human race or the human body, you have to find something else that's organic that people understand in a very simple, principalic way.
Yeah, it's a very, very good point. Yeah, and yet what we tend to do is we tend to latch onto analogies that we think are obvious and simple and people can relate to, even if they're not always perfect analogies, like the car or the washing machine.
So let's think about this as an organic analogy, and we'll put that in the little box that goes, I'll think about that in a second. Hey, consciousness, give us an answer for that. Give us an analogy. And in about 15 minutes, it'll come up. So
okay,
moving from that thing, just the actual process of it, day one, day two, day three, these kind
right.
of changes that are actually happening in the body, can you describe sort of in your practice over that you've done over the years, what kind of changes that you see immediately in the midterm versus the long term?
Sure. To some extent, I can. First of all, I'll talk about the stages of the process, because I think it's important for people to understand what's actually happening. First of all, when we have our last meal, let's say at 6 p.m. tonight, and at 8, 9, 10, 1, 2 in the morning, you know, whatever time after that, if the body needs something, typically it's looking primarily for glucose because we run on sugar. Sugar is our primary fuel normally, under normal conditions. So the body's looking for glucose. It looks to the digestive tract. And once we get beyond about 8 to 12 hours, even though there is likely still material in the digestive tract, we can come back to that, it's not going to be of much use to the body at that point. And so once we're somewhere between 8 and 12 hours into the process after the last meal, you know, this puts us, what, between 2 and 6 in the morning the next morning, if your body is looking for something, fuel, it's going to be going to the liver for glycogen reserves. So glycogen is a glucose precursor, which means the body can easily, readily convert it into sugar, into glucose. And we store glycogen in both the liver and the muscles. But think about this for a second. Let's say that, like other animal species, we're living in the tropical jungle. We, let's say you break your leg, you fall out of a tree, you're lying on the ground, you can't really move, you don't have access to food, you're by yourself. So what do? You make, you prop yourself up against the tree, you make yourself comfortable, you rest for 1, 2, 3 weeks, whatever, however long it takes, until you feel well enough to get up and walk, you know, and go do whatever you need to do. The first thing you're probably going to want to do is go find something to eat. Well, you see something to eat, but it's in the tree up above your head. And you're going to have to jump up and grab a branch and pull yourself up into the tree. Wouldn't it be useful if you still had something to fuel your muscles? So the body doesn't deplete muscle glycogen when we're fasting. It keeps it intact because your body doesn't know that you've decided you're not going to eat, and that when the time comes, we've got a staff that's going to serve you watermelon. They don't know that. The body doesn't know that. The body just knows there's no food coming. And so it keeps muscle glycogen intact so that it can fuel the muscles should you need them to be able to get those that first meal in place. Once the liver glycogen tends to last, again, about 8 to 12 hours. So somewhere between 16 and 24 hours, let's call it 20 hours. We'll split the difference. You know, approximately 20 hours into the process, we've used up all the liver glycogen. And the body is now looking for the next way that it can get some fuel so it can keep doing whatever it needs to, including having the heartbeat, running the brain, you know, all these things. Everything requires fuel. Even if we're doing absolutely nothing, that's called basal metabolic rate. For the average person, it's over 1,000 calories a day, so say the experts. And, you know, that's if we're doing absolutely nothing, lying still, not moving. Okay, we still need that some number of calories, whatever it is, to run the body. So where does the body go next once we have no liver glycogen? Well, what we all hope happens, and, you know, what everyone would like to happen, and what many people believe, even some people who should know better say happens, is body fat. Wouldn't it be great if we went to body fat? That's not what happens, unfortunately. And why exactly it doesn't happen I'll give it a shot. You know, I'll tell you what my theory is, but we don't really know. We don't really understand exactly why it is, how it is. But what happens next is the body actually begins to convert muscle into sugar. It's a chemical conversion process. The body takes small amounts of muscle tissue, converts them into sugar. There we have the glucose we need.
That's cortisol. It releases cortisol that eats the muscle tissue that converts it. And that's why people who sprint for very short periods of time as a training method have huge muscles. And that's why people who run a marathons for a very long period of time are skinny as a rack.
Right. Yeah. No, but and the question wasn't so much, I think for me, the question is not so much what are the actual mechanisms, but more of a question, why would the body use muscle when it's got fat? Because, you know, if you think about this, again, for most people, the idea of long-term fasts is relatively foreign. It's relatively radical. But think about the fact that we store body fat on the body. The body stores fat for one reason. That's because in nature, there are droughts and floods and fires, you know, conditions that occur naturally from time to time where getting a meal is difficult. And so what the body does is it ensures that we have reserves so that if we can't eat today, tomorrow, for the next 4 or 5 days, we don't die. You know, I started out by joking that most people believe if they skip lunch, they'll probably die. I mean, I think people actually do believe this, you know, not in lunch, but a few days, a week. Most people think you can't survive that long. But it's not unusual for species to have to go that long. And there are many cases. You can Google this. You can find stories of dogs. They fall into a well. They get trapped in an empty house, or, you know, something happens and they can't get a meal for 3, 4, even sometimes 7 or 8 weeks. And at the end of that period, they're very skinny, but they're still alive. And, you know, this is what happens. So what we're doing when we're fasting is we are consciously choosing to allow the body to use up the reserves that it's been storing our entire lives specifically for this purpose, for times where we're not eating food. We're not taking calories from outside. So if we have fat reserves, why would the body choose to use muscle? It's a great question. There's theories about why this happens. There are people that say there's an MD who says that's silly, that's stupid, it wouldn't do, you know, why would the body do that? He says, if you think that's what happens, measure muscle mass. Take measurements. Interestingly, he fasts people and doesn't take these measurements. We do. For the last 12 plus years, we've measured more than 3,000 people. And what happens is everybody loses muscle in the first week. And in fact, and you know, natural hygiene, which is a hundreds-year-old philosophy of health, which says our health, you know, we have to align ourselves with the laws of nature. It looks at fasting as the natural way because this is what happens in nature. It looks at a natural diet for our bodies. It looks at how do we meet our body's needs as naturally as possible. And natural hygiene has always said, yes, we know this is what happens. The body consumes muscle, and then it starts consuming fat, but it continues consuming a tiny amount of muscle throughout the process because your brain and a couple of other organs in the body require sugar. Everything else can switch over to running on ketones, but the brain needs sugar, and there's precious little sugar available from metabolizing fat. So we get it by converting tiny amounts of muscle. Now, in a fast of 21 days, most people, you know, it's not like you're going to see your bicep decrease over the course of the time. There appears to be a significant loss of strength for most people while fasting, but that's actually because they've got toxins in their bloodstream, not because their muscles are getting much weaker. Usually at the end of the fast, people are practically as strong as they were before. They're going to lose something, but it's easily rebuilt because their body, if done properly, the body's going to be more efficient than it's ever been before. So I believe what's happening. I believe the reason why the body goes to muscle before fat is very simple. We, as I said before, we're set up to run on glucose. And because there's no glucose available from fat, the body says, not how do I get fuel, but how do I get glucose? Because that's my preferred fuel. And the idea is, you know, again, your body doesn't know, let's say my client's body doesn't know that the client has decided he's not going to eat for the next 21 days or the next 26 days or the next 30 days or whatever it is. It just knows, well, it's been another 12 hours and there's no calories that have come in. So how do I meet my temporary relatively small needs? Well, let's take just a tiny bit of muscle. That way we don't have to change fuels. We're already running on glucose. We're going to make some glucose this way. Okay. And so the body does this and it does this and it does this, you know, for a couple of days. Finally, it says, all right, you know what? There's still nothing coming in, but I don't really want to lose any more muscle. So now it's time to go ahead and make the change over to this alternate, safer, long-term, safer fuel source. And it switches over to running on fat by metabolizing fat, running on ketones. I believe that's why this happens. But whatever the reason, you know, whatever the reason is, it's definitely happening. We've measured it over and over again. Anybody who's ever done a long fast and you know, here can tell you because they've seen these numbers. They can actually see it happening.
So it goes from a little stage where it consumes the muscle, then goes on to consuming fat?
That's correct. And that's right. And it is a little stage. That for the average person, somewhere on around day three or so, the body starts to switch over to fat. And remember, the first 24 hours, it was doing something else. So it's about, for the average person, it's about 2 days of using muscle as the primary source of fuel. But then it begins to transition to fat. So for the first 10 or 11 days, it's still using some muscle, a little bit less each day. By the time we're 10 or 11 days into the process, we're running almost exclusively on fat, only using muscle to fuel the brain.
Mm. And it some other like very minor. Emergency and recovery. So in the first part, your body's like, oh, it's an emergency. We need glucose. Oh, it's not an emergency. It's going on for ages. Ah, we'll just start eating into the fat, bro. She'll be right.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's exactly what happens. So, but that's the stages of the process. And when we get to about 21 days,
Deeper. Hormonally, yeah. I'm not sure if you've measured this, but what happens to the patient's hormones when that switch happens from going from releasing cortisol to releasing the fat?
Well, we don't measure hormones. We don't hear, we're a non-medical facility. We're here for people who don't trust the medical world and want to do it in an alternative way. And so we check blood sugar. That's the only blood test we do regularly. We have the ability to run other blood tests if necessary, but it means bringing someone up here to do it, because we don't do that on site. We can do it here, but only if we bring someone in. So it's not something we do regularly. I can't really tell you exactly what's happening. Now, there are some things that we know happen hormonally. Human growth hormone, which is called the youthing hormone, by the time we are about 18 to 20 hours into the fast, we've got about 3,000%, about 30 times the normal amount of human growth hormone in the bloodstream. That's before the first day is over, and it continues to go up. And this, again, this is the youthing hormone. So this allows the body to heal in ways that we don't heal otherwise. Now, you are probably aware, I'm sure you've heard about telomeres.
No, tell me about it.
Okay. So over the last 20 years or so, maybe a little bit less, the field of genetics has changed quite a bit. There's now something called epigenetics. But one of the things that geneticists are aware of is that on our DNA, we have these little tails. They're called telomeres. They're like a little tail. And as we live and as we encounter free radicals and as we do all kinds of things, they get shorter. They start out very long and they get shorter and shorter. And the shorter the telomere, the shorter our lifespan. Okay, the faster we're aging. And so there is one, there are various things that people do. I'm sure you're familiar with all the people out there these days that are trying to hack, you know, all these life hacks to do this and do that. I personally, as I said before, I believe that the most effective thing we can do is, rather than try to manipulate the body into creating a particular outcome, get out of its way. Because our bodies are virtually infinitely intelligent with regard to their own needs. Now, you seem like a pretty smart guy. I like to think I'm a reasonably intelligent guy. But I think it's true that neither one of us is anywhere close to infinitely intelligent. Our bodies know exactly what they need. You and I have some ideas. Sometimes they're pretty half-assed. Sometimes they're completely assed. We're not going to outthink the body. So the best thing to do, rather than try to manipulate the body, is to simply get out of its way and let it do what it knows exactly how to do. Okay? This is what I believe is the best thing. This is what's worked for me and for thousands of my clients over the years. So although there are other ways to do this, other ideas about ways to do this, the one thing that's been proven to lengthen telomeres once they've become shorter is fasting. And so there was a study published just a few years ago where they took a group of rats, and you might have heard about Pottinger's cats. We may have even spoke about this 5 or 10 years ago, but Pottinger's cats, this was an experiment from about 100 years ago, where Francis Pottinger took groups of house cats, divided them into groups, fed one group raw food, one group cooked food. To make it simple and quick, the cooked food cats, after 3 generations, were all sterile and couldn't reproduce, and the experiment ended. But they began to develop all kinds of health challenges right away. The second generation, there were all kinds of birth defects and all kinds of disease conditions. The raw food cats, completely healthy all 3 generations. They could have kept going. So there was a reprise of sorts of this experiment done just a few years ago, except it was done with rats. What they did, oh, by the way, before we go any further, I will say, for the record, I'm a 32-year vegan. I don't believe we have the right to use animals for any reason, including experiments. I don't wear leather, silk, wool, anything else. But these experiments exist. It's interesting. There's information here for us. I'm going to talk about it. I'd like to see them stop happening. But they took these rats. They fed one group cooked food, one group raw food. Now, you know how dogs, they say 1 year for us is like 7 years for a dog. So there's some equivalent for rats. I don't know what it is. I don't know how many years 1 year of our life is for a rat, but they
You don't hear this phrase often. Yeah, but how much is that in rat years?
Right, exactly. But let's say it's 5 or 10 years, whatever it is. when these rats were the equivalent, the raw food rats, when they were the equivalent of 80 years, which is a little bit longer than the average human lifespan. Most of us in the developed world now live to about 79. So when these rats were about that age, a little bit older, they killed them and autopsied them. And the raw food rats were completely healthy at the age of 80. All healthy organs, their body looked great, no arterial plaque, you know, no, there was no apparent damage of any kind, no apparent aging. When they were at what is theoretically the end of their lifespan, they were completely healthy. They took the cooked food rats, 100% cooked food, and at half that age, they killed and autopsied them, and their bodies were completely riddled with disease. It looked bad. They had a third group, which I didn't mention before. This group was also fed cooked food for the equivalent of 40 years, right? Their equivalent. But they didn't kill them at that point. They fasted them instead. And then they put them on a raw food diet, and 40 years, equivalent of 40 years later, they killed and autopsied them, and they were completely healthy. So this, you know, this is the most recent study that I'm aware of that actually shows the power of the process and what happens.
Thinking back on that analogy that we were talking about why would the body do such a thing as to go through specific processes that is really actually objectively quite good for it? Why would you naturally be drawn to certain things? And I was thinking about being an organic vessel of infinite universal consciousness. What would an organic vessel of infinite consciousness do to itself if it was in a situation like fasting? Well, exactly what it is doing, isn't it? Because it's thought about it, it's experimented over for millions of years, allegedly, and what have you. It knows intuitively. So the organic example of fasting is, what do you do when you know intuitively that what you're doing with your life is the wrong thing to do? You find a solution intuitively, don't you?
Exactly. Right?
And so the body's done the exact same thing.
That's right. Exactly right. So what happens when we're doing this is we're literally growing younger in every measurable way. The body, our bodies, in every single moment of our lives, they know exactly what does and doesn't belong in the body. So when we're fasting, what happens is the body targets all that stuff that doesn't belong there and eliminates it through various channels. Now, we have five primary channels of elimination from the body, okay? From the cells. Now, you know, if we're looking at inside the body, then we're talking about some different things. For instance, we've got the lymphatic system, and we can talk about that a little later. But when we're talking about actually getting the stuff out of the body, there are five primary channels: through the urinary tract, through the colon, through the skin, right, through sweating, through another means, through breath.
Exhalation, People don't realize that the way fat leaves the body is in the form of carbon dioxide. That's why when you're doing lots of exercise where you're breathing all the time, that's why you're losing weight, bro, because you're breathing it out.
As well as through mucous membranes, eyes, nose, mouth, ears, vagina, etc. These are all mucous membranes, and these are ways that the body's detoxifying. So each of these channels depends on having sufficient water. Nothing moves without having enough water in the body. And this is why we water fast people. Now, since we last spoke, when you and I last spoke, very few people had ever heard the term dry fasting, but it has become the rage. You know, it's one of these fads. I hope it will cease to exist. I personally know of two young people, both in their 20s, now dead as a result of severe dehydration from dry fasting. Without having sufficient water in the body, there's very little cleansing or healing that's happening because nothing happens without water. Now, people point to the fact that animals in nature don't drink water when they fast most of the time. And that's absolutely true, at least most of the time. They don't. But there's a reason for that. And it's important to understand. Animals in nature, their entire lives, they're eating the diet that their bodies were intended to eat. And that diet, no matter whether we're talking about a carnivore, a foliovore, an omnivore, an herbivore, foliovore, animals eat foliage. Giraffes, for instance, are foliovores. They live almost exclusively on leaves on trees, from trees. Something you and I, actually one of our close primate relatives is a foliovore. While most of them are frugivores, chimpanzees, bonobos live primarily on fruit. Mountain gorillas are solitary animals. They move deep into the jungle. There is less fruit deep in the jungle because fruit trees require sunlight. And most fruit trees aren't the tallest trees in the jungle. They're usually understory trees. That means they're not getting much sunlight. So you're going to find more fruit trees at the edge where you've got, you know, two different habitats that come together. But the gorillas don't want to be seen there because they're solitary. So they move into the jungle and they eat primarily leaves. It requires the ability to digest mostly cellulose, something you and I can't do. Right? We're not cellulose eaters. Cows, sheep, and goats are cellulose eaters. They've got four stomachs, whole colonies of bacteria to be able to break down what is defined. If you look up cellulose in a dictionary, human dictionary anyway, might be different in a cow dictionary. In a human dictionary, it says indigestible fiber. In a cow dictionary, it says food, man. This is food. Cellulose, right? Termite dictionary, too. Termites eat wood, which is mostly cellulose. You and I have a lot of trouble getting much benefit from eating things high in cellulose, which is why, a little off aside here, I don't recommend eating a lot of the superfood, you know, things like kale, lauded for the fact it's loaded with nutrients. It's also very, very difficult for our bodies to digest because it's loaded with cellulose and other complex carbohydrates that our bodies can't break down very well. So my simple rule of thumb is, if you could take a leafy green and make a pair of shoes out of it, don't eat it. Okay, soft, tender leafy greens only. But anyway, coming back around, when the body has the chance, amazing things are happening because it's finally able to target all this garbage that it knows didn't belong. It's going to start getting rid of it. It's eliminating through all these various channels as long as there's enough water in the system, right? Animals, they've got the water in the system because they've always maintained their optimal diet. I don't know about you, Vinny, but I grew up eating a standard American diet. You probably didn't. You grew up eating a standard diet from your country.
No, trust me. The New Zealand diet is the standard American diet. It's
not so different.
It's just, instead of having entire aisles full of candy bars, we've got entire aisles full of everything that's bad for you.
Right. Yeah, I get it. But, you know, think about the way people start their day these days. A bowl of cereal, dry cereal, a lot of water in that.
A lot of sugar.
Not exactly. A lot of sugar, a lot of garbage, a lot of chemicals, but no water whatsoever. In fact, you may recall this. I probably shared this with you before because I love this one, this little piece. You know, you've eaten corn chips in your life, yes?
Yes, I have. And they're dry, but that's not how they come out. Where did all that moisture go, folks?
Exactly. Remember that. Yeah.
So I just had a couple of points to make. We're going to be coming to break any second now. Okay. Because I was talking about how animals only eat what they're naturally inclined to eat and that kind of thing, whereas we eat all sorts of crap, right? But what we do sometimes in certain cultures is we bless the food and we thank the food for sacrificing itself to keep us alive, and that actually on a biochemical level changes how your body absorbs it, interestingly enough. But when we're doing fasting, unlike an animal, we've got all this toxic crap in our stuff. What do you do when you've got toxins in a river? The river keeps flowing and the toxins get washed out. Why do the animals have all of that stuff, ladies and gentlemen? Chlorophyll, the exact same molecule, more or less, as an iron molecule, which is what we need to eat as well. So we'll get back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with Lauren Lockman. Don't you go anywhere. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of that show the intelligence agencies just love listening to. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show on American Freedom Radio, broadcasting live, ladies and gentlemen. It's just so good. You can actually feel the reality in the voice. If I fuck up, nothing can save it. And my very special guest is Lauren Lockman. Welcome back. Now, we're in the middle of this thing we were talking about, flushing the body from the toxins using water and stuff like that. And a thought occurred to me. Hydrogen. Yeah. And oxygen is two of the most important variants going on in the human body, right? And that's what water is. It's H2O. But there's another compound which has an infinite manner of arrangements of hydrogen and oxygen and carbon when we're carbon-based life forms, and that's cannabis, the cannabinoid molecule. There's actually 200 different types of molecule. And when your cell detects one, it goes, oi, I need this particular arrangement. And the cell frickin' arranges itself into whatever your cell is craving and inserts itself into it. And that's why it appears to sort of work for everything, because it's linked to our endocannabinoid system. Now, again, these are just arrangements of hydrogen and oxygen, and it's about healing the body. Where else can you get heaps of hydrogen and oxygen from your water, obviously? So it's kind of interesting how there's a connection between how many diseases, misnomers and things like that in the human condition that can be helped, if not cured, by cannabis. Is probably an almost similar quantity between those that can be helped and cured by frickin' fasting. Wouldn't you think?
Well, to be honest, I'm not so sure. Personally, I think that certainly if we look at cancer, for instance, where people are using cannabis extracts to kill tumors, that's a very powerful benefit. And yet, I have friends who promote cannabis oil, for this purpose, CBD, and tell people that it's completely non-toxic, and I don't believe that's true. I believe that it is toxic to the body, but much less so than any other alternative that might be available right now. So it's a lot better than chemotherapy. It's a lot better than radiation. It's probably a lot better than a lot of other options. I'm not so sure. Again, as I said before, I personally believe that our bodies, like every other organism, are self-healing. So I don't know that cannabis is going to heal the body. I'd be happy to be proven wrong. My goal is to help people heal, not to cling to a particular way of doing that. I don't really care what the method is. My goal is to help people. In fact, health is really just a vehicle. I think you would agree. You were talking earlier about consciousness. We're not our bodies. We're much bigger than our bodies. Our bodies were born. They're going to die. I don't believe that you and I ever will, because I believe that we're part of the divine creative energy of the universe. But that's a belief. It's not neither here nor there. We're really talking about the physical health of the body right now. Personally, for me, it's just a vehicle, because it's really about helping people maximize their potential, manifest everything they're capable of manifesting. It really pains me to see so many people living their life. And I think, I believe everybody has genius in some way. For some people, it might be genius mechanically, and for some people, it might be artistically or musically or some other way. But everybody has some genius, and every one of us has a specific combination of traits and gifts. That means that I can manifest things that no one else can manifest, and you can manifest things that only you can manifest. In fact, I believe both of us are to a great extent, living our missions right now. Unfortunately, a lot of people aren't doing that. A lot of people are living lives where they're doing something they don't even enjoy doing, because they feel like they should, or they don't believe they have other options, or it feels secure to them. Whatever it might be, it's not a joyful experience. And this, unfortunately, is becoming increasingly common, where people are not happy, and they're not fulfilled, and they're not joyful, and they're not really enjoying their life at all. And, that's the last thing I want to see anyone do. So my goal is to help people maximize their potential, manifest everything they're capable of manifesting, and live a life that they're actually happy to be living every single day. And for me,
that's strangely, because that's exactly what I'm doing with my show. It's just we're coming at it from two different angles. And that reminds me of what we said on the show the last week, I think it was, with Freder X, how he said that there are many roads to get to the top of the mountain, and everybody should use the road that they each get drawn to.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm not so sure there are many different ways to do a very particular thing. But again, if the idea is to get to the top of the mountain, absolutely true. No question about that. So, yeah, I get that about you, right? I think we may not agree on every single idea, every single method, but ultimately the goal is the same.
Yeah,
and that's awesome.
I get that with every intelligent person who's dedicated their lives to something that doesn't just benefit them. They all think in an identical fashion. And that was right. What Dr. Leonard Caldwell called the one truth, which religions have all been trying to convince people. Now, we've got the one truth that, no, actually, the one truth is living your truth. That's the only one that there is, and that's why everybody who's doing something good for humanity thinks almost entirely similarly to each other, just with different little tapers on the end there to individuate themselves, because... if you've got infinite consciousness, then it would also be infinitely subjectively expressive, so that it could define one part of itself from the other.
Right. Very well said.
But I'm just making it up as I go along. So.
No. Yeah, I think you're absolutely onto some significant truth here, and I can see that whatever it's been, another half a dozen years or so since we spoke, you know, obviously. One of the benefits to you personally of doing this show is you're taking in amazing information all the time. You're engaging in amazing conversations all the time. Your own head has to stay open to be able to have a conversation like this. And that's incredible because, again, it's very easy for people to fall into a rut where they're thinking the same things and hearing the same things and having the same conversations with the people who believe the same as they do. And unfortunately, there's not much opening available from that.
Exactly. So, it's very much the opening dialogue of John C. McGinley in the movie Point Break. You're coming in here and you know less than nothing. You might, if you knew that you knew nothing, at least that would be something, but you don't even know that yet.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. And as I'm sure you're well aware, you know, Buddhism teaches that we approach everything with beginner's mind. In other words, I don't know anything. You know, we're open because even you know, here I've guided thousands of people. I've run the largest dedicated fasting center for over 20 years. And yet I believe what I know about fasting is tiny compared to everything I don't know about fasting. You know, again, even the experts today, how many cells are in the human body? Well, the estimates by the experts range, and I think this has changed a little bit over time. They used to say 10 years ago, some were saying 50 trillion cells, and others were saying 500 trillion cells. That's a pretty significant difference. How big is your house, Vinny? I'm not sure if it's 2,000 square feet or 20,000 square feet, right? It's a pretty significant variation there.
It's margin of error, to be sure, which leads me to believe when people have enormous margins of error, they don't know what they're talking about.
I think the point is that the human body is so complex. You know, every day, certainly every year, there are startling developments, realizations that, oh, you know what we've been telling you for the last 20 years? Yeah, that's completely wrong. You know, now we know it's this. And, you know, and so... there was a book written probably 20, maybe 30 years ago by Dr. Lewis Thomas called The Youngest Science, in which he said, when we look back on medicine as it was done 100 years ago, you know, we look back with horror. He said, 100 years from now, they're going to do exactly the same thing.
I'm looking right? at the medical industry with horror as we speak, actually, because it's technically the leading cause of death. All right. So, you know, if people want to get afraid of things, you know, be afraid of hospitals. Why haven't I been to a hospital in 20 years? Right. It's not because I'm afraid of them. It's because I know how to take care of myself so that I can avoid them perpetually.
That's right. Yeah. Well, like you, you know, I have been to hospitals, unfortunately, because I continue to engage in things that are somewhat dangerous to my physical body. So, I like to surf and ride motorcycles and rock climb, and I haven't slowed down at 57. And so I break bones sometimes. And when that happens, in fact, it's interesting. I've never had a bone set, but I have had a couple X-rays just to see. I thought I might have broken my back 4 or 5 months ago. Decided it might be a good idea to find out. You know, I've had I once severed an artery in my wrist in two places in an accident and thought maybe it would be good to get that sewn back together.
Yeah.
Right.
And that is when you go to the hospital, ladies and gentlemen. Is it an injury or something wrong with your health that could have been caused in a war or a battle or something like that? That's only thing they know how to do, because the entirety of the medical industry was based on warfare and always has been.
Yeah, trauma medicine, they're really good at. You know, and if you're listening and you've just cut an artery in half, go to a doctor and have it sewn back together. It would be a good idea.
The naturopath is not going to be able to help you, bro. Oh, here's some supplements, you little.
Well, you know, it's entirely possible that artery too could heal itself. The problem is you're going to bleed out in 15 minutes, and it's not going to happen that quickly. So, you know, but for everything else, anything else, in fact, when I've had broken bones, when I've had anything my body need to heal in any way, I was, you may recall, we probably spoke since then, I was bitten by the most poisonous snake in Central America. That was 7 years ago, and I fasted only, and I'm still here. So, you know, I allow my body, I get out of its way, I allow it to heal no matter what it needs to do so far in every single instance. That's the one thing that I allow my, now, if, you know, again, sewing something back up, that's a different story. But any real healing that needs to happen, I'm going to give my body the optimal conditions to heal by fasting, by ensuring that my body's not, that healing process isn't competing for energy with my digestive tract, which uses most of my energy every day if I'm eating.
And I think this is the crossroads between the biological and the mechanical, is that medicine looks at the body as a machine, whereas holistic medicine looks at it as an organism. And that's why when you have mechanical problems, you know, like, for example, an artery cut or something like that, you go to the mechanic. But when you've got anything else wrong, you go to somebody who knows what they're talking about, who's less likely to frickin' kill you with stuff that's frickin' addictive for the rest of your life. You know, just
exactly. Yeah. So, you know what? Cancer came up in discussing cannabinoids. When someone talks about whether it's using CBD or whether it's using chemotherapy, here's what drives me crazy. Because we see people here. It's changed over the last 5 years, three or four years anyway. We started to see a lot more people coming to us as a result of my YouTube channel. Got a significant presence on YouTube. And
in fact, Lauren, point in fact, you know why you're on the show right now? Because my wife has been researching fasting and she stumbled across one of your videos and she says, Vinny, this guy's really awesome. I go, I know, I've interviewed him a couple of times. Actually, I'll get him on again. Thank you, Babu.
Well, thank her for me too. So what we're you know, I think we have more men watching YouTube than women. That's what I understand, and more young people.
Yeah,
our
YouTube channel's around the, 69% men, 31% women in terms of audience demographics. So, yeah, that's about right.
And that may be a little less surprising given your show. I think the nature of your show, that's maybe less surprising. I was surprised.
Talk radios, in general, around about the 10% mark for women. I've got exactly. three times that.
That makes sense. But the fact that it's talk radio, it's almost always men, isn't it?
Yeah.
So here, you know, women are definitely have always been more proactive in terms of their health. You know, your wife researches fasting. Guys are like, yeah, you know, my leg's falling off. My eye doesn't work, whatever. And they don't do anything until someone says, hey, you could do this. Where women are going to say, well, let's see. Let me go on and see what I can figure out about this. And that's always been the case, even before it became much easier to do with the search engines and all the things we have online today. So back in the old days, the first 17 years we existed, our clientele was about 70% women. And now we're about 50-50. But it used to be heavily women. And we have seen dozens of women here who had breast cancer. They were coming because in almost every case, we rarely see someone dealing with cancer for the first time. What usually happens is they had breast cancer 5 years ago. They had a lump removed, or in way too many cases, they had a breast removed, and now they've got cancer on the other side of their body. And they were surprised. In every case, they were surprised because some doctor said to them, cancer's gone, you're completely healthy. They were given a complete clean bill of health because there was no more cancer, no more tumor in their body.
Whoa. How did you find that out, doctor? Well, we scanned it with radiation, which causes cancer.
Exactly. You know, and here's the thing that people fail to understand. I think most people really believe, as doctors seem to, that if you have a tumor, there's a problem, and if you don't, you don't. But that's not really true, because we have to understand that a tumor is a symptom of a problem. It's not the problem. It's a symptom of the problem. The cancer is caused by two things which have to coincide. They have to coexist. One of them is toxicity. Okay, you know, if toxicity is coming into your body through toxic particulate matter like cigarette smoke, then lung cancer is likely to be where it shows up. If you're putting chewing tobacco in your mouth, it's going to be lip, gum, tongue cancer. If it's, you know, if it's state troopers in the U.S. with radar guns on their laps, it's testicular cancer. It depends on what part of your body is being affected by toxins and how much of them it's being affected by. But toxicity is a major factor. But there's a second factor. It's important to understand that every body, every human body, they say, experts say, has cancer cells forming every day. And yet, and this has changed a lot in my lifetime, today only 50% of the population develops cancer. Only 50%, right? Look at that. Wow. The other 50% of us, those of us who don't have tumors, how come? That's because our immune systems are healthy enough to destroy those cancer cells as fast as they form. Okay? So cancer develops where there's toxicity and an immune system incapable of doing its job. But you have to have both of those things present.
And what's one thing that stops your immune system from working properly? Stress. What's the one thing that's ubiquitous in the current working world? Both going to, enduring, and coming home from work to keep you alive. Stress. Ah, so 50% right. of people got cancer, right? Is it by chance a coincidence that, like, most of those people get cancer more than once, and the people who don't get cancer ever are actually not living stressful lives that don't fulfill them personally? What a fucking coincidence that is. I didn't see it coming. Yeah, nobody saw it coming, you know.
there's no doubt that, modern lifestyle choices play a huge role. And I say choices consciously because, you know, people believe that they have to do what they're doing, but that's not true. Remember Lily Tomlin, the American comedian?
Remind me.
Lily Tomlin. She's been in movies. She had a big role in the early Saturday Night Lives back in the 70s. If you ever saw those, you probably weren't alive then.
Yeah, well, that's an American broadcast, and we didn't get Saturday Night Live here. We got a lot of the pre-made, prefab sitcom shows and things like that,
like Friends.
And the higher brow American stuff. So we don't get all the junk. No, I'm just kidding. Saturday Night Live's great.
Lily Tomlin once said, "The problem with the rat race is that even if you win, you're still a rat." Okay, so. You know, but people think, well, I've got to do this. I've got to go get that job and commute back and forth to work, etc. And there are many people today who say, you know what? I'm not doing that. I'm going to disengage from that. I'm going to create my little homestead and grow my own food and make a little bit of money doing something, you know, but not have all the same needs that I have when I'm trying to keep up with the Joneses and live in suburban wherever. Because if you're in the suburbs of any big city, it's not cheap in most cases. You know, there's other ways to live. It's just a choice, like every other thing. It's a choice. People don't realize that, but it is. So, you know, if we make the best choices, including finding ways to maintain a high level of emotional balance, cancer is probably never going to happen. It's been said that cancer only develops. Carolyn Mace, the famous medical intuitive, says cancer only develops in the presence of suppressed anger. So find a way to deal with those suppressed emotions, find a way to create a level of emotional balance. Yeah. And there's probably no risk of these things showing up. But let's look at cancer. So we've got two factors that have to coincide. We have to have toxicity and we have low, poorly.
Oh, sorry, Lauren, you just dropped out for a second here. We have to have toxicity and?
And we have to have a poorly functioning immune system. Okay. Now, if we have those two things, we're likely to develop cancer. So if we eliminate the tumor, but we've done nothing about the toxicity and nothing about the immune system, well, we have done something about the toxicity and we have done something about the immune system. Because virtually every means of eliminating tumors is toxic to the body and damaging to the immune system. So what we've done with toxicity and immune function as a result of treating cancer, in most cases, is we've made them both worse. this is the cause of cancer, and we've made it worse. Why are we surprised when cancer comes back? Okay, there's no reason to be surprised. This is exactly what's going to happen. This is why I tell people, look, whatever you decide to do, whether you choose to get radiation or chemotherapy, which, you know, cancer doctors don't get chemotherapy because they know better, or you choose to use CBD or you, whatever you choose to do, you want to understand that you still have to give your body a chance to get rid of the toxic garbage by fasting and to heal the immune system by fasting, because fasting is the most efficient way, most effective way to do both of those things. We do that, and there won't be cancer. Go ahead.
Now, two interesting things just occurred to me while you're doing that. This is how I work in conversation. I listen to what somebody's saying until such a point as something, it triggers a memory in me. Then I continue listening to what they're saying until such a point as I have the opportunity to relive that memory. And there was a study where they had two groups of women who had a cold, and they put them in a room that had comedy shows playing, and the girls were laughing their ass off. Then they put the other group of women in a thing with normal news, action movies, drama, you know, that kind of thing. And then they measured the activity of the immune system before going into each room and after coming out of it. The ones with the action and drama, news, things like that, no change in the immune system function. The ones who'd been exposed to 4 hours of comedy, on the other hand, they had something like a 75% increase in their white blood cell count, right? Like, laughing your ass off actually helps your body to relax.
Absolutely.
And fight
absolutely
the stuff that's going on. Happiness, yeah, and joy literally heals you, okay?
Absolutely.
And which reminded me again of another thing that one of my listeners who lives in Trinidad and Tobago, and his grandmother living there, 96 years old, still not dead. And this was like 5 years ago that I talked to her, so it might be a different case now. But she's smoking a pack of cigarettes a day and drinking half a bottle of scotch every day, right? And she's 96 years old. And so I asked him, so bro, by chance, has she got a whole bunch of old friends who are also around the same age who also smoke that pack of cigarettes and also drink about half a bottle of scotch, and they're all smoking and drinking together the whole time throughout their life, laughing their asses off? And he goes, yep. And we go, that's why they're still alive.
Well, you know, since I think when we spoke last, I was in Panama, and I'm now in Costa Rica. I've been here now for 6.5 years. Actually, in September, it'll be 7 years in Costa Rica. We celebrated our 5th anniversary at this particular location back in March. And we are located not just in Costa Rica, but in Guanacaste on the Nicoya Peninsula, in one of the world's blue zones. And I can tell you from living here.
Well, sorry, it's, define, you know, blue zone.
Sure. Blue zones are the places on the planet where people tend to live the longest historically. Okay. So there are, I forget, 5 or 6 or 7 blue zones. This is one of them right here. And what happens is people here don't live longer. First of all, I should say again, this is historically true. I know a lot of the younger generation because some of them work here and I interact with them, and you know, I know what they're doing. I seriously doubt that they're going to continue to see the same benefits as their parents and grandparents, great-grandparents did, because they're not making some of the same choices. But you know, the diets here, historically over time, were not the healthiest diets in the world. They also weren't the worst diets, because up until just a few years ago, there was no processed food available. So even though people were eating all manner of things that I personally don't think are optimal for the human body, they were at least fresh, whole, in most cases organic, until fairly recently. But the biggest thing that differentiates places like this area from other places is the strong, very strong social networks that people have. People feel supported. They have strong familial relationships. They've got strong friendships. And that probably is just as important as anything else.
Yep. And that reminds me of when Chief Sitting Bull encountered first the colonials, and he was taken aback because he saw something in a meeting with these colonial people that he never saw in his own culture. People sitting around talking without laughing. He'd never seen that before.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, typically when people get together, you know, in cultures like this, people get together, they enjoy themselves. But I don't know why it is exactly. I mean, I have some ideas about why it might be, but you're right. I mean, there are many settings where people aren't doing that. In fact, in the West, often that only happens if people are consuming alcohol or something else to loosen them up, right? You know, wouldn't it be cool if we could find a way to be able to talk and feel comfortable without needing to use toxic substances to do it?
Well, indeed. But of course, the mere fact that if you're having fun while you're on those toxic substances would actually cure whatever cancer it's creating and still leave you with the complete experience, theoretically speaking. And well, also, throughout the entire history of mankind, we have always used substances to take ourselves into altered consciousness. And that reminds me of what David Icke says. Now, I don't know if you've watched a David Icke presentation, but he doesn't do a lot of laughing. He tells jokes and things like that, and the audience laughs, but he doesn't. When he took ayahuasca and he was retelling this experience, the thing that he noticed immediately was he was rolling, literally rolling around, laughing. And I identified that because when I first took mushrooms, I think I was 18 years old, and that is exactly what I experienced. I had this profound connection to things. Now, this is why people get together and talk and laugh and things like that, because nothing is funnier to infinite consciousness than sitting across from another representation of itself and exploring the little differences and the little similarities. That is the biggest cosmic joke in the world. That's why people are social. They always like to see around and look and compare and laugh about the things that, through completely different means, they both found funny.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. You know, I mean, I think there's a whole this is a big area, the use of recreational substances, mind-altering consciousness, etc. I experimented with substances earlier in my life. I enjoyed it very much at the time. I wouldn't necessarily discourage someone from experimenting. I reached a point where I preferred being fully conscious and fortunately don't need a social lubricant, don't need something to make me laugh. It's easy to laugh. Life is pretty funny. I'm, you know, pretty hilarious. If you're willing to actually look at yourself honestly and not so critically, it's pretty easy to be amused. So fortunately, that's not necessary. But I think you're right. It's absolutely critically important that we find a way to enjoy life that way. We talked about that earlier.
Yeah, yeah. So I was listening to the Joe Rogan Experience, and they were discussing dimethyltryptamine. And this person was talking, Joe was talking to them, and they're saying, you know, dimethyltryptamine was the greatest trip. It's my favorite drug and everything like that. And he was like, when was the last time you took it? And they go, oh, I don't know. 30 years ago. And he said that's actually the difference, is because once you get bumped up to that higher level of consciousness, you don't need it anymore.
Well, I don't know that you ever really need it. I mean, we can disagree about that. That's okay. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. I'd like to believe it's possible for us to get there without it. But I think if someone...
All the spiritual teachers say that that's exactly the same thing. And drugs are a shortcut, and all shortcuts are dangerous.
Exactly. Exactly. It's easy to get in trouble. But you know, it's each of us has our own path. You know, I'd say we should be able to do what we choose to do. And, you know, it's kind of silly that certain substances are illegal. Other things, perhaps it makes more sense. But in any case... Yeah,
we always get down to this in the last 30 minutes of the second hour, ladies and gentlemen, when you just get exhausted from talking properly, you know. And we're getting back into the fasting motif here, because I was trying to get that back in there now, because during the conversation we also approached the concept of raw food and how how they've been tested with rats, cats, and so on and so forth, and how the raw food's been really good for them health-wise and things like that. And more recently in human history, people have been discovering the raw food diet and the benefits that thereof. People with diabetes going raw for 30 days, don't have diabetes anymore, and so on and so forth. And nearly everything that we eat on a day-to-day basis is cooked. And if those experiments are anything to go by, the cooked food-eating rats were full of disease, and the raw food-eating rats were not. So if we have a look at our society currently with the overprocessing and this kind of thing, we have a ubiquitous and, I believe, a deliberate depopulation agenda going through the human race. Essentially, we're being ground through that big meat grinder. They've discovered what makes us sick. They've discovered what makes us weak. They've discovered what makes us stupid. They've discovered what reduces our attention span. And the reason why they're attacking those things is because those are the only things that can save us. Those are the only things that will motivate us to destroy these people who are trying to kill everybody and enslave us all, right?
Well, you very well may be right. Certainly, these are possible scenarios. I don't spend much time focusing. I don't have time to listen to the programs. I'm certainly aware of the ideas, but there's no question that in terms of diet, makes all the difference in the world. You said a moment ago that most of what we eat is cooked, and certainly as a culture, that's absolutely true. I haven't had a stove for more than 20 years, so I don't eat anything cooked. I've been 100% raw vegan. I'll hit 27 years this fall. And there's absolutely no question. I believe it's a significant part of the reason why I haven't been sick a day in 32 years. Why I still wear the same size clothes I wore in high school, where I'm still strong and fit without having to work very hard at it. The diet makes a huge difference. There's no doubt about it.
And as we say, this diet is affecting everybody, right? And you've gone onto the edge of that bridge that says, after you've got bad diet, bad lifestyle, bad this, that, and the other, you can come here, all right? And we will get you back to starting point, right?
That's right. Although I think, in fact, it's important to say, because I've been a 26-plus-year raw vegan myself, and am reasonably well known in raw vegan circles, we get a lot of people here that already get that. And a lot of people that, or they stumble across my videos, as your wife did, they change their diet. And then they come here because they realize that's the next step. And we've had people here who've been over 30 years eating a raw vegan diet, still see tremendous benefit as a result of fasting. And that someone asked me today, they said, well, you know, because of my work, I can't really fast more than one day, but if I just eat optimally, how many weeks or months will it take to get the same benefits as coming and doing a 21-day fast with you? And I haven't responded yet, but you know, it's not weeks or months. It might be 20 or 30 years. It might be more. Because everything changes, as I said before, there's a whole cascade of beneficial physiological changes that occur only in the absence of food. What happens when we fast cannot be compared to what happens when we're eating optimally. There's really no comparison. It's a whole different paradigm. And this is why, in the experiment that I share with you about the rats, they fasted them. This, you know, there was a study published at the University of California, Santa Barbara, I believe, just a few years ago that said that fasting for 3 or 4 days completely rejuvenates your immune system. Now, to be honest, when the study was published, I had a group of people here that were on day 19 or 20 of their fast. And I shared this with them, and they all thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever heard, because what had happened for them in the 15, 16, you know, 17 days since they supposedly had completely rejuvenated their immune system was amazing. You know, it's not like they get to 3 or 4 days and then nothing else happens. No, it gets better and better, more and more powerful as we go. My guess is that, first of all, I mean, I know for a fact that what they studied was only fasting that long. They didn't look at what happens beyond that. So the effect they saw, they believe that's 100% function. They believe that we can't function better than that. But what if we could function 3 times better than that, and they've never seen it? Because who they're looking at are average people who've been consuming a standard diet and putting it into a body that's significantly dehydrated and relatively poorly functioning. And when I say significantly dehydrated, you know, I touched a little bit earlier on the hydration piece, but we've actually been measuring hydration levels here, as well as muscle mass, for 12 years. And we see the average person coming in approximately 15% dehydrated. Now, medicine says, no, you can only be like 3% dehydrated. But again, that's, what if they're assuming that 85% is 100%. So what they're saying is, well, you could be 82%. That's 3% off. No. What if they're completely miscalculating what's actually possible? You know, they say a baby is 75% water, but adults only 60% water. Well, that may be true, but perhaps it shouldn't be that way. Perhaps that's not the way it was intended.
Maybe it's because the baby is eating liquid baby food and having breast milk that it's got a higher concentration. But as soon as you start eating dried Doritos and stuff like that, your hydration comes down for some reason.
Exactly. Well, in fact, we never really closed that loop earlier. Thank you for bringing us back to it. You know, the whole Dorito thing, this is how people get dehydrated, because they live on cereals and breads and pastas, even meat. You know, look at a carnivore, right? They eat meat. They kill an animal. They drink all the blood first, right? Then they eat the water-rich internal organs. Then they eat the muscle, and they don't cook most of the water out of it and put it between two dry pieces of bread, right? They just eat it as it is. So they're eating the whole animal, and it's filled with water. Humans cook most of the water out. They eat all kinds of dried things, chips, breads, pastas, rice, grains, cereals. They use alcohol, caffeine, which are diuretics. They use salt, vinegar, herbs, spices, which are pulling water out of the body. And all of these things dehydrate people. And so the average person is starting out their process significantly dehydrated. I talked a little tiny bit about dry fasting. Taking the average person who's already seriously dehydrated and fasting them without water can only possibly serve to make them more dehydrated. There's all kinds of claims for dry fasting. You know, people say, well, it's three times more powerful. And they say that because your body enters ketosis in most cases, the average person's case, on the first day instead of the third day. Why is that? That's because when we metabolize fat, we produce perfect water. Now, the dry fasting proponents, some of them are now telling people, well, that only happens if we're dry fasting. If you're drinking water, your body doesn't. That's complete nonsense. Anytime your body is metabolizing fat, one of the byproducts is water, perfect water. So the average person dry fasting, their body is going to go into ketosis almost immediately because it's desperately looking to find water so it doesn't die. That's a traumatic condition to be. That's a traumatic state to be in. And a body in that state's not doing a whole lot of cleansing and healing. Mm. It's just trying to stay alive.
And to back this point up, Mark Twain once said, be careful in reading health books. You could die of a misprint.
Exactly. Yeah. I love Mark Twain. This is the thing. People are constantly misinterpreting what's happening. People say, no, I feel better dry fasting. Well, of course you do. That's because your body's not doing much. Okay. Fasting, the whole point is to get out of the body's way so it can express the symptoms it needs to. Because symptoms are evidence the body's cleansing or healing. If you don't have enough water in your body, you're not going to express many symptoms. People say, when I dry fast, then the mucus immediately disappears. Well, do you know why? Mucus is made over 90% of water. So if your body is seriously dehydrated and you're in danger of death, the mucus is going to dry up. Now, people think, and unfortunately, I mentioned earlier, I learned about fasting. One of my primary mentors was Arnold Arendt, rational fasting. And Arendt taught, as do some modern people, teachers, gurus, whatever, teach that mucus is the problem. Mucus is the cause of disease, right? No, absolutely not. Mucus is not the cause of disease. Mucus is an intelligent response by a virtually infinitely intelligent body to toxicity. Your body creates mucus to encapsulate something that doesn't belong so it can more rapidly eliminate it. If we eliminate the mucus, we've taken the body, this incredibly intelligent organism's best way of dealing with something, we've eliminated that. Okay, that's not helping. We're going to feel better, but again, we're only treating a symptom that way. We're not addressing the underlying issue. We're just addressing a symptom. This is not really helpful. Okay, and it's really important to understand this. So there's actually no science. And I mean, listen, again, people have said to me, well, you just say what you say because you run a water fasting center. Well, think about it for a second, okay? If I believed that dry fasting was more beneficial or more powerful, we could just as easily not serve water, right? We'd save a lot of money on running a pump to pump the spring water up to the top of the property. We'd save a lot of money on, I have four housekeepers who spend hours a day filling pitchers of water. I could probably get rid of one person on my staff, if we weren't serving any water, maybe two. That's how much time we spend doing that. To me, it makes no difference. In fact, if it was true, if I could fast people for a week and get the same results they're getting for 21 days, there'd be a lot more people willing to come.
And that we could makes charge me more. Suspicious that the people who are running these dry fasting programs are doing so with a profit motive. Hey, it's much cheaper than doing them.
Well, there aren't many people running programs, probably some. Most people are doing this on their own. And, and even the proponents of this typically recommend not going more than 3 or 4 days. Why not? Because you become dangerously dehydrated. And yet I saw something, complete facepalm moment.
Whoa. Let me just say, this is the philosophy of dry fasting. Dehydrate to yourself to the point of death and then have a drink of water. It'll be good for you, bro.
Well, so I saw something finally where, they realized, okay, maybe that doesn't make sense. So someone said on Facebook the other day, this is a detox specialist, right? Said, quote unquote, detox specialist said, no, when you're dry fasting, your body becomes more hydrated. So I'd like to know how a dehydrated body becomes more hydrated by dry fasting.
When no, again, I hang out with morons, I become more intelligent.
Exactly. Well, it appears that way. Maybe it appears to be more hydrated, but exactly. If we go back to animals in nature, cows eat grass, chimpanzees eat fruit, gorillas eat leaves, anteaters eat ants, and each of those four diets is high in water. Okay. Every one of them is getting a diet that's primarily water. Only humans, the only species on the planet that feeds itself. Now, we also feed dogs and cats, farm animals, circus animals, laboratory animals. We feed them processed garbage that is devoid of water. And those species are the only species besides us that have the same frequency of cancer, heart disease, arthritis, diabetes. These diseases are virtually unknown in nature. The only exception, cancer is quickly growing in nature. Why? Because we're creating a toxic environment. Okay. But, aside from that, these other conditions virtually never show up in nature. That's because species are eating their natural high water content, 100% raw diet. Now, they're not all vegan, but some animals have a digestive tract that allows them to eat animals and not develop disease as a result. You and I can't do that.
It's because the molecules in red blood is a iron-centered molecule, but it has the exact same amount of electrons and protons and in the precise same arrangement around it as a chlorophyll molecule, the green chlorophyll which you get out of plants. Now, the center of that atom is slightly different than the iron molecule, but
it's magnesium instead of iron.
Yeah, and so the body can process either one, and because the cells, the structure of those is virtually identical, it doesn't matter which one it's eating, and that's where you get occasional herbivorous creatures, even dogs eating grass and so on and so forth, because they're capable of processing those two things simultaneously because they're virtually identical.
Yeah, there's definitely similarity. My understanding is dogs and cats use grass primarily as an emetic, which is to make themselves vomit something they want to get rid of. But in any case, your point is well taken. And I think the point here is simply that animals in nature are all eating high water content diets, and therefore they have the water in their body. They're not dehydrated. And because their bodies are going to manufacture water and they're starting out already hydrated, they have the water they need in the body. But if you take a dehydrated animal, you're going to have a different result. And so about 2.5 years ago, two or three years ago, it was this summer, it'll be 2 or 3 years, I was in Gdansk, Poland, doing a full-day seminar. And I was talking about this very point, and a man raised his hand. And I said, yes, is something you want to say? He said, well, I'm a veterinarian. He said, cats and dogs often drink when they're fasting. Why? Purina cat and dog chow, right? Because they're eating mostly kibble, dry food. And so they're just as dehydrated as the average person is. Okay. Animals in nature. I had another veterinarian say to me this year, this is a large animal veterinarian, said, animals in nature, when they need water, they will seek water when fasting. Only people who've made, you know, come to some conclusion for whatever reason, however ridiculous it might be, that they're better off being dehydrated, don't drink water when they need to. So, you know, I think, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, no, I'm sorry. It's my show and I shouldn't interrupt you. But I'm going to. Now, it reminds me of something Krishnamurti said. He said, I don't tell anybody anything. I merely ask them why they asked me. So some guy at one of his gigs goes, so do you believe that we get reincarnated or not? And he goes, why do you ask? Right? And the reason why people reach those conclusions about dry fasting and things like that is because the person's telling them to believe something. They don't go, why do you think that? And allow that person to explain why they think that and then suddenly come to the truth on their own. It's the difference between having faith and having hope. Faith gets rewarded. Hope usually gets betrayed because you usually hope for things on the spiritual realm with other people. Like, I hope this guy's not lying to me to make some extra money off of firing one of his staff members so they don't have to fill up the water, but I'm going to go for it anyway and hope for the best. When you've got faith, on the other hand, that's usually something that's backed up by infinite consciousness in tune with natural law. There's actual rewards. There's something that actually manifests as true at the end of it. That's what you reach when you start asking yourself as infinite consciousness, what is this thing? Should I be doing it? Versus having hope that somebody has already done that and just take their word for it. Okay?
Right.
That's why the health system is such a big thing. And I think maybe a lot of health practitioners of all fields are very trepidatious about just talking about what they think sometimes when it comes to health, because we hold it right here in the chest sometimes. I know what I know about health. I know what I know. And it's like, you don't. You just don't.
Right.
That overconfidence in our knowledge, I think, is our greatest downfall.
Well, I completely agree with you. The biggest problem for many people is believing their own ideas and beliefs. And, you know, and look, I could be accused of doing exactly the same thing. The difference is, what I'm trying to do is, A, look at what happens in nature. B, apply logic and science. You know, I've looked at dry. I mean, again, I want to know the truth, right? For myself, for my clients, for the world at large, I walked away from a lucrative business to do something that hasn't proven to be all that lucrative. I never expected it would be. But it felt like something that would allow me to serve the world in a much bigger way than what I was doing before. What I was doing before was I was serving wealthy people, helping to make them wealthier. And now what I do is I try to help everyone become as healthy as possible. So for me, it's all about what's true. And it, you know, it's that's it. And I'm willing to look at every idea, but, you know, again, explain to me how taking a dehydrated body and making them more dehydrated, you know, not drinking water is going to make them more hydrated. There's no science, there's no logic to support these ideas. But I think one of the reasons, so you may be absolutely right about part of what's happening. I think there's another part, though. One of the reasons that this happens so frequently is because most people don't really want to change anything. And so what they're looking for are magic bullets. You know, I got a message today from a woman who said, okay, you know, I've got this particular form of arthritis, you know, can you help? You know, will fasting help me? And do I need to fast 21 days? And I said, well, and this was someone who was writing to me, someone I know from a lecture tour in South America, writing to me from Chile. I know she doesn't have a lot of money. I know it's going to be difficult for her to do this. And I said to her, unfortunately, with that condition, most people need to fast 26 to 30 days. You know, it may be difficult to do, but that's what likely needs to happen to actually heal the body. So it's, you know, I'm not just going to tell someone what they want to hear. I'm going to tell them what I believe is true. what most people wanted. And so, you know, in her case, let's say 30 days. First of all, you know, can she find the money? Can she take 6 weeks off from her career? Which is that we're talking about a 6 week process. 30-day fast with me is 30 days fasting, 12 days through guided refeeding. That's a big deal for a lot of people, taking 6 weeks out of your life. How do people, so what most people want to do is they want to believe that there's a magic bullet, that they can take 3 days, 4 days, they can dry fast, they're going to be healthy. That's going to take care of it. And because people often do feel better, because symptoms are suppressed, because they're dehydrated, they believe, they want to believe that this made them healthier. I haven't seen any reason to believe that this is true. I do believe in invest. I mean, I'm not going to do things that I think are, you know, potentially fatal or incredibly stupid, but I have dry fasted myself twice now for 4 days. And where people say three times the benefit, I saw zero times the benefit. It wasn't more beneficial at all. I've fasted, by the way, I fasted quite a bit in my life. There are some fasting practitioners who have fasted once or twice. I have now fasted cumulatively more than 2.5 years of my life, around 900 days of my life. So I have a little bit of experience with this personally, as well as having taken thousands of people through the process. We have people here all the time. In fact, in this session, we have a session ending on Saturday. We operate in usually 10-week sessions. And we've had several, 25, 30 people here on this last session. Several of those people had experienced dry fasting. Every one of them leaves here saying, oh, this is way more powerful. Or, you know, or, well, I got way more benefit than I got from dry fasting.
Now, lastly, we've only got like maybe a minute or so left. The dangers of coming off of your fast, the guided refeeding, because I heard a story about some dude who goes, you know what? Hey, I've finished my fast. I'm going to have a boiled potato. He was dead because his body wasn't used to eating.
Right. Well, I don't know. I haven't ever seen that happen. I don't know if eating a boiled potato would kill someone or not. I've heard similar stories of people eating meat coming off their fast and dying as a result. I don't know. But I believe that it is important to very gradually, gently bring someone back. And some people think you should use juices because that's more gradual and gentle. And, you know, again, I think about this personally. You may or may not recall this, Vinny, but I'm not a huge advocate of juicing. I lived on juices myself once for 120 days, only juices. I used to do a lot of juicing and juice fasting. However, it occurs to me that juices are largely oxidized because things oxidize very quickly when you separate them from their cellular structure, that they are fragmented. You're throwing away the pulp, which has been proven to contain essential nutrients. They are imbalanced because, for instance, vitamin C is a, I know we're almost out of time, so I'll keep it simple. I don't believe juices are optimal. We don't use juices. What occurs to me is there are 25.5 million other species, and every one of them eats whole food to break their fast. But we start people out with tiny amounts of high water content, easy to digest things like watermelon, papaya, fresh out of the coconut, not bottled, pasteurized, but fresh out of the coconut water. One of the benefits of being in Costa Rica, we have all three of these things 12 months of the year, all the time. Over the course of, depending on how long their fast is, anywhere from 1 week to 3 weeks, they're going to consume a little bit more each day. They're going to have maybe a little bit more time between meals. They're going to have more choices as time goes on. We start out with three choices. By the time they're finished, they might have 8 or 9, 10 choices, depending on what time of year it is. But it's definitely important that we do it carefully.
Indeed. Yeah. Final point. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate today. And the links to Lauren's website will be in the description. Catch you later, folks.